For a period of approximately 3 years, 1998 to 2001, this school district, District 221, was on notice and had knowledge of the fact that this child was not receiving a free appropriate public education in terms of his behavioral needs, in terms of his academic needs, in terms of his occupational therapy needs, and in terms of his social work needs, etc. The evidence in the record was that if the school district had addressed his needs academically, behaviorally, socially, sensorially, beginning in 1998, that, to quote David Piles, Dr. David Piles' testimony, the entire situation that unfolded tragically in 2001 was, in his opinion, preventable. Dr. Reed Schwartz, who testified similarly, testified that, in his opinion, that the time to have addressed things was in kindergarten and first grade, when things were simpler, less intractable, and more easily remediable. That, in fact, did not happen, despite the fact that the district knew of the problems and, from year to year to year, just simply closed their eyes out of an abundance of ignorance, and in third grade, out of an abundance of a desire to rid themselves of this child from the school district, as the hearing officer found. The hearing officer and the district court both, in fact, opined that this was a situation that had been unfolding for a period of years. This was not a situation, as the school district argued, that unfolded in a mere 5 weeks, that all of a sudden he became, you know, a behavioral, that he had behavioral problems that had never been accounted for before. The record reflects, and I think we need to be clear, that when I use the word behaviors, I am not meaning necessarily behaviors which rise to the level of being disciplinary infractions. Behaviors, as defined in the law, both the federal and the state law, are those matters which impede the child's education. In kindergarten, first, second grade, there were serious behaviors, but they were not of a disciplinary nature. This child had not been a disciplinary, had not had any disciplinary infractions in those years. He had had issues regarding noisemaking, regarding being off task, being distractible, which were, in fact, attributable to his disability. If we had addressed those issues, if we had gathered data, if we had created good plans for this child and come up with good strategies and methods on how to work with him,
I'm not sure I understand this argument. There was no complaint about the plan for his kindergarten year, was there?
Well, there was no plan.
And in any event, it's rather too late to set plans for his kindergarten year.
The point is, Your Honor, is the train left the station in kindergarten, and the train...
But I don't understand what that has to do with the statute.
Okay.
In time T, one doesn't complain about what the plan was for year T-4.
Your Honor, I'll move on. The issue in the case is that in second grade and in third grade, this child was denied a free, appropriate public education. The hearing officer found that for a variety of reasons that in second grade he, and based on the abundance of the record from his teachers, from his aides, that this child academically in second grade made virtually no academic progress. From his speech therapist, he made virtually no progress in terms of his speech and language goals. That is a classic denial of FAPE under the Supreme Court's holding in Rowley. Is a lack of
whenever
progress.
The child doesn't make progress, it must have been the district's fault?
No, Your Honor.
That's what you just said.
I'm saying that he failed to make progress because they failed to provide him with appropriate services. The evidence was that
those are different things. The statute deals with inputs, not with outputs or outcomes.
And the inputs, Your Honor, and the evidence was overwhelming that the teachers in second grade really did not know how to teach him. They did not have sufficient plans on what to do to address his needs. The classroom aides which were working with him were similarly situated. They similarly did not have the training, the planning, the preparation in order to provide for his needs in an appropriate fashion. And as a result of that, he was in fact denied a free appropriate public education in second grade. And that followed tragically into third grade. as well.
And so what would you have suggested be done in the second grade year? Because in February, they held a conference to discuss his performance. This is of his second grade year. And then in April, we had the school psychologist evaluation, and then in April, the functional behavior analysis. What do you think should have been done instead?
Well, frankly, one of the things was that they shouldn't have waited from February to April in order to create the FBA. And in fact, in April, when they did create the FBA and did this analysis, they came up with the fact that the child was off task 44% of the time. And did they create a behavior intervention plan at that time? No. So that was one thing that they should have done. Another thing is that they should have recognized the fact, as the classroom teachers testified, that the child at the beginning of the year was the same child at the middle of the year was the same child at the end of the year. His resource teacher, who was a special ed teacher who was trained in LD and didn't have specific training in the types of issues that this child presented with, testified, I mean, her report from February of 2001 was that he was off task virtually minute by minute. I mean, this is a child who is not functioning well in not subtle ways, but in obvious ways. And the simple answer to your question is that they should have acted at that point. They could have and should have acted even earlier in the year in second grade. And they just went on and on. And frankly, because he was a sweet, caring, and affectionate child who wasn't creating a disruption at that time, he flew below the school's radar screen, and they simply chose not to act, even at the point that they had at least a suggestion of data, not well done, but data, nevertheless, which showed that he was 44% off task. We don't develop a behavior plan when we're off task almost half our day. I mean, that to me, I think, is emblematic of the types of issues that this child has faced throughout his school career, and certainly in second and on into third grade. The issues, Your Honor, as addressed in the brief from a legal standpoint, were that the district court made a fundamental error of law in its legal analysis. The issues as framed before the hearing officer, the issues as taken up by the district court, were that this child was in fact denied a free appropriate public education in second and third grade. The district court nevertheless, on the one hand, said that it was deciding issues of faith, but on the other hand, applied the legal analysis of LRE, least restrictive environment. And that under Rowley, under Beth B., that is an incorrect legal analysis. As this court has found in Beth B., that to make a conglomeration of the LRE into the FAPE analysis is to create analytical confusion. That on the one hand, the FAPE analysis, and I quote from Beth B., is absolute. And that is in contrast with the LRE, the least restrictive environment analysis, where we get into balancing factors such as in Ronker and in Rachel H. and in Oberti and for that matter in ZS and a variety of other cases where this court and other courts around the country for any number of years have gone into a balancing of factors. Beth B. again recognized the fact that FAPE turns on the now familiar standard of did this child receive a meaningful educational benefit. It is not the standard of the reasonable actor which the district court applied. And in applying that analysis, we move from incorrect premises to incorrect conclusions. And frankly, even if the district court were to have applied correctly, which I would submit they did not correctly apply a correct analysis of reasonableness, and even if this was in fact an LRE case, which it is not, except for the fact that part of one remedy deals with LRE, the fact remains is that there was nothing reasonable about what happened to this child in third grade, and for that matter in second grade, as I've already stated. And I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Certainly, counsel. Ms. Crank.
May it please the court, I'm Nancy Krent, and together with my co-counsel, we represent the Forestville Valley School District 221. This case is a situation of tragic facts unfolding rapidly, spiraling quickly, and a school district that, as the district court correctly found, responded appropriately and reasonably in the face of those circumstances. The district court applied the correct legal standard. It did not make an error of law. The district court analyzed this case both under the FAPE standard of whether this school district's actions were reasonably calculated to provide educational benefit, and also under the analysis of least restrictive environment. And it's difficult to understand why the parent now thinks that least restrictive environment isn't appropriate, since the issue with the case was the issue of the fact that the child had been removed from the regular education environment. And in fact, the hearing officer's decision specifically says she is placing the child back in the regular school environment because she doesn't believe that the parent's request for that placement has been disproven by the school district. The hearing officer committed a clear error of law because that is clearly not the standard that can be applied. This court has repeatedly held that the school district is not obligated to choose the parent's preferred placement. Rather, the school district is entitled to deference which, as the district court correctly found, the hearing officer utterly failed to give. And the hearing officer incorrectly found that the correct placement, the least restrictive appropriate placement, would have been the regular education environment. And one needs only look back a year or so to the decision of this court in ZS to find that, in fact, on very similar facts, this court specifically held that in the face of a spiraling, violent child, the school district is entitled to make reasonable judgments. And here in this case, in a period of approximately four weeks, we had the first violent episode from this child September 25th when he filled a glove with rocks and started hitting other students. A week later, another violent episode where he ran across the street to a body shop, picked up a piece of metal and started swinging it. A week later, an episode where he was assaulting the teacher. The teacher ended up with scratch marks across her chest. And so on. In that same four or five week period, the school district convened its IEP team five separate times, finalized the behavior plan that it had started the spring before, amended that behavior plan to try to deal with the aggression, amended the placement again to move him to another school where he could be reunited with the teacher, and even then, on the very first day of that plan, utterly failed. As in ZS, it's possible that what the school district did was wrong, but it clearly was not unreasonable, and the hearing officer had no authority to substitute her judgment for that of the school district in finding that it was unreasonable. And I think that as I said, the court has applied both legal standards. The court also looked at whether or not, on the broader issues, FAPE was violated prior to that four-week period, and the court clearly found, having applied the correct legal standard of reasonably calculated to confer educational benefit, that the school district did not. In fact, the record was very clear. The record was that in kindergarten, first grade, and at least through the first part of second grade, the child was making adequate progress. When things began to become difficult in second grade, and again, this had nothing to do with violence or aggression, that was not something that the district could have forecasted. The district did what it was required to do under IDEA. It convened the IEP team. It had been doing informal behavior planning. It undertook more formal behavior planning. It consulted with experts. It consulted with its own school psychologist. It consulted with the cooperatives low-incident specialist, Jerry Gelander, who, by the way, is the only person to have testified that she had experience with this child's disability. And also they consulted with the state's Project Choices, a state-created agency to deal with these issues. I think it's instructive to look back at this court's decision in Beth B. and also at the district court's decision in Beth B., which talked about dealing with a child with a rare disability. In Beth B., it was Rett syndrome. In this case, it's a syndrome called Landau-Kleffner syndrome, a syndrome which apparently has only been identified over the last 50 years and I believe has only had a few hundred incidents of it reported. That's what this child suffers from. In this case, the school district did what it could. Dealing with a rare syndromic condition, it found an expert, Jerry Gelander, from its cooperative, who had worked previously with a child afflicted with Landau-Kleffner syndrome, to gain the knowledge that it could in order to assist it. With regard to whether the child made adequate educational progress in second grade and third grade, according to the hearing officer's decision, the testimony was that the child may have had a mental age of about five. Third grade is set at a curriculum for children at 9 years old. It is not clear whether in second or third grade this child could have continued intellectually to succeed. And indeed, because this case was ruled in favor of the parent by the hearing officer, the placement that the hearing officer ordered was implemented while this case was being heard by the district court, and the district court took additional evidence. That was the subject of the additional evidence provided by both sides to the district court. This child was in school 30 minutes a day, 3 days a week, and of that, only 10 minutes were spent in a classroom.
This is under the hearing officer's order?
Yes. That was the private consultant that she ordered to be employed, and I think that it's instructive in looking at how the hearing officer substituted her own judgment for that of the school district. The remedial section is very instructive in that point. It is clear that the hearing officer substituted her own judgment. She would not allow the school district to continue to program for the child. She insisted that private consultants be brought in at the taxpayer expense, but without the control of being employed by the school district, and that it was the private consultants who would then set the program for the child, who would set the curriculum for the entire school district with regard to a disability curriculum that was to be imposed on all grades. And that, I think, is emblematic of her overreaching. And I think the district court properly found that she had, in all respects, substituted her own judgment for that of the school district officials, which is where both the statute and this court's decisions require that discretion be placed and that deference be given, because it is the school district officials that have the educational expertise that must ultimately be relied on in programming for all children in the school district.
Where is Alex now?
Alex I believe that Alex is being homeschooled, that there was an IEP developed for the student after the district court's order was issued. The parent has indicated that she is not willing to bring the child to be educated at the school district without the private consultants being there to supervise.
And in terms of the district court's finding with respect to a current placement, did the court provide a basis for finding that what the school district had come up with was the least restrictive environment? What was the district court's finding on that and the rationale for it?
I believe what the district court found was, in light of the incidents that occurred in September and October of 2001, that it was that the school district properly determined, did not make an unreasonable determination, that the least restrictive environment appropriate for the child was a special program in a separate special education facility. It was a self-contained therapeutic program. Unfortunately, because this is a rural school district, that program is located at some distance from the home, but that is the nearest available program for this
child. And how far is that from the home?
I'm not sure that's in the record. I believe it's approximately an hour. It may be more. There is no closer, so far as I'm aware, the record doesn't reveal that there's any closer facility. I believe that with regard to the deference owed to the district court by this court, this court's prior decisions are also clear. There was no error of law. The district court addressed both the state standard of reasonably calculated to confer educational benefit and the LRE standard set forth in the Beth B case, the ZS case, and others, and that therefore only if the district court's findings were clearly erroneous should this court consider reversing the district court. And we believe that it is abundantly clear, both from the record, from the district court's opinion, and from our brief, that in fact the district court's decision was not only not clearly erroneous, but it was quite correct. I think it's also instructive with regard to the level of review that in the decision that this court issued in ZS versus Wisconsin Dells, that in talking about the level of deference owed to the hearing officer, this court found that even under a heightened level of deference, to substitute one's own judgment for the judgment of school personnel was clearly erroneous, was an error of law, and therefore would have been reversible either under great deference or under the more limited deference given when additional evidence is taken and a factual review is conducted, because there's only a preponderance of the evidence standard in the review that the district court conducts of the hearing officer's decision. Furthermore, I think that with regard to the issue of whether or not services provided in earlier years should have been forecast to foresee that someday this student would run into this violent, aggressive spiral, is turning the idea of reasonably calculated on its head. The idea that somehow in kindergarten, in first grade, or in second grade, this school district should have been able to prognosticate that a child with no history of violence or aggression in school would in fact turn violent and aggressive, it's hard to fathom. It's hard to fathom how we can look back in 2004 and say in 1998 it would have been better if you'd done that. I think everyone looking back now says, well, if only we'd known then what we knew now, maybe we would have programmed differently for Alex, but that can't be the standard. It can't be the standard here. It can't be the standard in dealing with any child. That's an insurmountable burden for any school district.
When you describe yourself as a rural school district, is that...
Yes.
Is that different than, let's say, a big city where there may be a one place in a city of a million people that would be able to better deal with this than in maybe a rural school district?
I think in dealing with a small rural school district, resources are much more limited. The availability of consultants is more limited. Obviously in a city like Chicago with major medical facilities, it's much easier to obtain those resources. I think also, for example, in this case, there was some issue raised by the parents as to whether or not passive restraint training should have, the staff should have received passive restraint training sooner than it did, within that 4 week period after the students started to become violent, the staff should have all received training in the appropriate techniques of passive restraint. Unfortunately, in these rural areas, that sort of training is very difficult to arrange, and indeed could not be arranged in the 4 weeks in which these events were unfolding. Again, hindsight being 20/20, would it have been better if that staff had been trained when this child was in first grade or in second grade? Of course it would have been. And I think looking back, the staff wishes someone had had the imagination to say, just in case the student ever becomes violent, or in case any student ever becomes violent, let's get that training now. But that's not the standard for whether or not it was appropriate. The standard is whether, given the facts as the district knew them at that time looking forward, the services it offered were reasonably calculated to provide educational benefit. We have a situation with a student suffering from a rare syndrome who may have a mental age, according to one witness who testified, of as low as 5 years, with a condition where the information about what sort of behavioral problems may develop in the future is limited. The district obtained the information that it could. It consulted with Jerry Gelander from its cooperative, who had experience with another child with this syndrome, who helped the district formulate some of the sensory and movement break options that it was using with the child. The school district did what it could. The school district acted reasonably. It acted reasonably in developing the IEP. It acted reasonably in determining what the least restrictive environment appropriate for that child was. The district court properly found that, and we asked this court to uphold the decision of the district court.
I just have one other question. Where specifically in the district court's order does it make that finding with respect to the least restrictive environment? Because there's lots of discussion relating to the syndrome and the activities of the... and perhaps I missed that line. I believe it's in paragraph
5, but I'm going to have to reread it
quickly to see if I can find the exact language I was looking for. I believe when the court finds that the district acted in a manner that was reasonably calculated to enable the child to receive educational benefits, and in paragraph 6 talks about the fact that they took a thoughtful, measured approach to Alex's education, that equals least restrictive environment, even though that language is not used. And normally we see that specific finding by the district court in situations like this. So you want the court to extrapolate to reach that conclusion?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe by the reference to ZS, which was an LRE case, that was a reference that the district court was making to the finding that, in fact, the district's decision ultimately to move Alex to the self-contained program.
But you agree that usually that magic language,
right,
that we look for is not there in the order?
I agree, and I believe that there is some discussion earlier in the court's opinion as to the issue of LRE, and therefore we assume that in fact that's what those findings were referred to. But it is a terse opinion.
Right, and then LRE is certainly not referred to in those words earlier in the opinion.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's correct. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Fox?
Your Honor, I was, in answer to Judge Williams's question, that's a creation out of whole cloth. The district court never reached the issue of placement, LRE otherwise. Mm-hmm. I mean, the district court simply did not understand the analytical framework in which it was called upon to analyze these FAPE issues. It did not reach placement, period. Mm-hmm. And counsel's representation that, in fact, the district court reached placement is wholly untrue. And I would like to pick up on the reference, because it's one of the very few cases that the district court cites and counsel has made reference to repeatedly, and that's the Wisconsin Dells and ZS case. And that is, if on the one hand, the district court would like to make an analogy, as counsel has made an analogy, that this child is the functional equivalent, and that he is an analog with the wild child that was described in ZS, something that we would hotly contest and totally disagree with. But for purposes of argument, if we accept the fact that he had, quote-unquote, suddenly turned violent, and we didn't know what to do, and we're a poor rural school district, and all of the things that are being claimed now, if that's one side of the coin, the other side of the coin that needs to be looked at is what, in fact, was the school district's response in ZS, which this court found to be reasonable, and that was this child was a danger in ZS, as the court found, that he was a wild child, and what was found to be reasonable was that the school district asked the custodian, in that case the grandparent, to keep the child home for 1 month while they figured it out, so he wasn't, in fact, in danger. Did they do that here? No. They sat and they created insufficient plans, ineffective plans. The unrebutted evidence, there was not a single school district witness who testified that the behavior intervention plans that they created were sufficient. And even if we assume, for the sake of argument, that the plan that was created on October 17th, which mandated in the event of an elopement, and this is a key point, that they were to follow on foot, follow in car, and call the police. On October 16th, Superintendent Lowell Taylor had countermanded that direction. Don't follow him. Call the police. Reasonable. There's nothing reasonable in this case. The school district, and in the person of Mr. Taylor, was not invested in reasonableness. He was invested in his agenda to rid the school of this child. He was keeping a secret dossier on this child beginning in early September. They take photographs. Do they bring it to the IEP on the 17th? Do they discuss it with the parent? Do they reveal it to the parent? Do they use it for educational purposes, for planning purposes? No. They keep it for purposes of ridding the school of this child, of spreading matters around in the community and defaming this child, and moreover, revealing confidential information to the police. That's what really was going on here. Reasonable conduct would have involved training their staff, reviewing policies, in a worst-case scenario, filing for a honing injunction, filing for an expedited due process, or simply asking the mother, we're in the deep end of the pool. We do not know what to do. Please keep your son at home, because here's the accounts of how bad things have gotten. We're at a loss. They don't do that. They keep it secret, and they keep the kid coming back over and over and over again until he nearly loses his life. They let him go into a cornfield under their watchful eye. This is not like the Martin case where the student went home and hung herself in the basement. This was done during school hours on their watch.
Would it have been the solution then to say, we don't know what to do, please keep him at home till we figure it out, and then we avoided all of this?
That certainly, as a matter of law under CS, presumably would have found to be reasonable, and it certainly would have been a much more measured step, one which put the child's safety paramount above all else. So the simple answer would have been that at a minimum they should have asked, and if the parent refused because she really didn't know how bad things were, they had remedies available to them under Honig v. Doe. They could have filed for a Honig injunction or filed for an expedited due process, because in their subjective belief, the child in fact posed a danger to himself or others. They didn't avail themselves of any one of those measured steps. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. We'll hear argument now in the case of Biondo against Chicago.